I am really grateful for the organizer and for the award committee to give me the opportunity to talk to you about today about the history of gigantism. This is a topic which is close to probably many of our hearts, as one of the reasons to become an endocrinologist is to look at the patient and make a bleak diagnosis. And there probably is nothing easier to make a bleak diagnosis of a patient with gigantism. So this lecture is in the memory of Dr. Clark Serwin, who was an endocrinologist fascinated by endocrine history. And there is a memorial library of the Endocrine Society with more than 8,000 books and materials, which is free for members, and items can be shipped. So anybody is interested, they can look up all their contents and contact the library, and they will send you what you requested. The award is also supported by Dr. Dalbert Fisher, who was a pediatric endocrinologist, and I'm very grateful for his support. I would like to start with a history of endocrinology, and this was written by Victor Cornelius Medvei, who is a fellow Hungarian who went at the beginning of the Second World War from Vienna to Barts Hospital, where I work now, and he wrote this book when he retired from clinical service. And on the front of his book, there is a picture of a patient, well, a person, and then some people say that this patient may have had acromegaly, while other people definitely deny it. So there are two reliefs of this person in the Berlin Altersmuseum, and you just need to judge for yourself what do you think. So as an outline for my topic, the oldest cases, definition of the disease, the genetic origin, the differential diagnosis, because not every giant is an acromegaly giant, and we'll show you that. I will talk at length about the Irish giants, probably one of the reasons why I've got this award. And then I will finish with giants in mythology and art. So, of course, the Bible comes to our mind when we talk about giants. And Goliath, his mother is said to have been Orpah, and she had several other children with a giant, well, who were also giants, and his height, according to the Dead Sea Scrolls, was about 200 centimeters. As many depiction of Goliath in art, and this is a lovely picture from an Italian scene in Florence. We can wonder, did Goliath's bitemporal hemianopia help David's attack? Well, we will never know. However, Michael de McDermott went even further. He suggested that because the stone was embedded into his skull, maybe he had osteoporosis due to the hyperparathyroidism and probably also hypogonadism, what he might have had. And also he had some bizarre rages, which are truly described in the Bible, of this unusual behavior. Could they be used to hypoglycemia, not hyper, hypoglycemia. So what I'm saying is, could he have had MEN1? Again, very unlikely, we will find out. But let's just forget the history of those myths and look at the real facts. So this is one of the oldest giants, has been found in Italy. And I was corresponding with this first author, Simona Minozzi, and we tried to extract DNA from this giant just to see if he might have a mutation in the AIP gene. But unfortunately, no appropriate quality of DNA, despite several trials we could get to test for this giant. It would have been interesting because in Italy a number of cases with AIP mutation has been described. This is another one from Norfolk in the UK, and the skeleton is currently in Canada of a tall patient who may have had acromegaly gigantism. And that's another case, again, from the UK, from Yorkshire, clearly showing signs of gigantism on the bones, which can be seen in the local museum. That's a case from Poland from the 12th century of a female patient's very typical skull. There's no doubt about the disease here. So the definition of gigantism is abnormally high growth velocity in children with abnormal IGF-1 and OGTT. Measuring the patient, we can think of patients who have more than 3 SD in terms of height for their age, or 2 SD over the calculated mid-parental height using country-specific growth charts. Gigantism is a rare disease, and it's very difficult to put a number of its prevalence. But to be a giant, at least an acromegalic giant, you need some excess growth hormone, but at the same time, you need to have that when there is an open epiphysis, such as in children or maybe older persons who have a delayed puberty. And the delayed puberty could be either due to the tumor, which is destroying the rest of the normal pituitary, therefore the LH and FSH cells. Also, it could be due to the co-secreted prolactin, which is inhibiting GnRH neurons via the kisspeptin and therefore causing hypogonadism. So this is an X-ray which was done in the London Hunterian Museum on the request of a very witty Swiss neurosurgeon, Dr. Landolt. He went to visit the museum, and he noted something and asked the museum to make an X-ray. And what he noted, that there were several nails at the end of the bone here, which were put there. And he saw that John Hunter, who prepared this skeleton, was a very skillful person. So why he had to use these several nails? And then on the X-ray, we can clearly see that these epiphyses is actually not closed, and this would have been separate from the bone itself. So that's why he had to use these extra nails. So looking at the X-ray, we think that his bone age was about 16 at the time of his death when he was 22, again showing the delayed puberty. Just know that they just quickly called him Charlie on this X-ray in 1978, which was then published in The Lancet. So the first description of gigantism, or actually acromegaly as such, was from a Dutch physician in 1561 who described a female giant who apparently was normal until the age of 12. She had her first menstrual period around that time, which was then irregular, and then from the age of 14 she had amenorrhea and extreme growth. So it was the first acromegaly case, as far as we understand, described by a physician, and it was also gigantism. There were several others, and then Pierre Marie in 1986, who was a French neurologist, obviously gave the name of the disease acromegaly, and he described several patients with acromegaly and also with gigantism. But what is interesting, that at the time he didn't realize the importance of the pituitary gland as the cause of the disease. And also he thought that acromegaly and gigantism are two different diseases. So there were quite interesting historical debates at the time. First of all, is pituitary enlargement in acromegaly, is there a cause or a consequence? As all the other organs are enlarged, they thought the pituitary is just one of the many organs which is enlarged in these patients. But then Verga, Minkowski, and Massalungo suggested at the end of the 19th century that there is a connection between acromegaly and pituitary enlargement. Then the other question was, is acromegaly and gigantism is the same disease or not? And it was Langer and Fischer and Klebs, again at the end of the 19th century, who suggested that acromegaly is an acquired disease, while gigantism is a congenital disorder. And then it was Cunningham and Sternberg who suggested that this is actually the same disorder, it's just with a different age of onset. But coming back to this thought here, is that gigantism is a congenital disorder. Now, with the recent discoveries in the last few years, maybe there is some truth indeed in this thought as well. So if it's a genetic disease, we should see that in twins. And yes, we can see that. This is a publication from 1982 from Japan, from identical twin boys. One started to have excess growth at the age of 7. The other one was diagnosed at the age of 17 with pituitary apoplexy. So I would suggest that these patients might have had AIP mutation because of the age of onset and also because of the apoplexy. This is another set of twins with extreme tall stature. And then the famous one, which is really important for my talk today, is these two twin giants stand together with their cousin, who was even taller. So all three of them are giants, but these two twins are also there, suggesting that there is a genetic link with their disease. And also siblings. So this is the famous picture from the Hugo brothers, and there is a patient from Vera Popovic, a girl who was 175 centimeters at the age of 10 when she was diagnosed. And then, again, two brothers from Ariel Barkan's patients with both of these families have an AIP mutation. So if we go back to the genetic background of growth hormone and IGF-1 excess, MEN1 was first described in 1903 by Adheim, and this first patient with MEN was actually a patient with gigantism. Then there were other descriptions, and then the gene has been identified for MEN1, and then a few years later for MEN4, again in a patient with acromegaly, but since then there is a young onset patient with P27 mutation recently described. Another cause of gigantism could be McCune-Albright syndrome, first described in 1922 and then identified the genetic alteration in 1991, and this is a very typical patient with a dysmorphic bone alterations also visible on his face, and then the typical skin lesion here. Carnic complex is not typically start in childhood, but there are childhood cases as well, and there are genes in the protein kinase tetramer, which would cause this disease in the majority of the cases. Very rarely, gigantism can be caused by in patients with neurofibromatosis, and this is a case of gigantism in a patient with optic glioma causing the disease. The largest group of patients are truly the familial acromegaly patients, which could be familial isolated pituitary adenoma or pituitary adenoma predisposition, and the recently described X-LEX syndrome, standing for X-chromosome linked acromegaly gigantism. So the first familial acromegaly, as far as I could find, as a depiction is the picture I showed you earlier with the twins, but as a medical description was in 1988, and there another one from 1999 of a particular patient. And Carvey-Cushing also described several families with gigantism and familial gigantism, and this is one patient who he mentioned has Mendelian tendencies, and he also mentions that this family would have interested François Rabelais because the maternal grandfather was also very big. So this is a patient based on the description in Cushing's book. I tried to draw a family tree. This is the proband patient, this one here, and that's a grandfather, and then there are several other family members, and he described that the children of this patient are very large at birth, which would not really fit with the X-leg or with the AIP disease, so we are not sure what he might have had. So many of the patients have a mutation in the AIP gene, and the first paper which actually suggested that it's not MEN1, which is also on the 11q13, but it's another gene at the same locus, was this one from France, and then the gene was identified by a Finnish group in 2006. And more recently, the description of the X chromosome linked microduplication causing the X-LEX syndrome. So here's a family with AIP mutation. This boy, just 2 weeks before his A-level, was taken to hospital because he practically went blind. And then it turned out that he didn't have any endocrine workup before his surgery, but the tumor was making growth hormone and prolactin. And this is his brother who two years later, because of his rapid growth, was diagnosed with the same disease. The little sister is also a carrier, but at this point unaffected. Here is another patient with AIP mutation who was operated by Jules Hardy back in the 70s. And what is really interesting that this patient had a microadenoma, which is rather unusual in an AIP mutation. And the brilliance of Jules Hardy, he actually cured the patient, although the patient obviously never got smaller. But his pituitary function is otherwise normal. So this is his family tree. This is this patient now. He is now in his 50s. And then you can see that several other family members, actually five of them altogether, was affected with the disease, and all these yellow subjects are carrier or obligate carriers. So the X-LAG has been identified just a few weeks ago, practically, by Professor Beckers and Professor Stratakis, with a very strong phenotype of normal birth weight, increased height soon after the birth, and a very high penetrance of the disease. Well, at this point, it looks that it's 100% penetrance. And because the gene is on the X chromosome, they see more girls, but it's not clear if that is the only reason why there are more girls. And I would like to show this patient, who is one of our patients, who already at the age of 7 months was actually quite large, large. And because she was a second child, the mother recognized that something is just not the same as with the first child and kept taking her back to the doctors even at this point. And the doctor ignored her until the age of 4. And by that time, she had a big tumor, so was treated with an yttrium implant. And then later with somatostatin analogs. And this is at the age of 7 after many operations and kind of getting better, but still obviously growing too fast. What is interesting, I just mentioned that in her early 20s, she was actually a beauty queen. So she you know, the treatment worked for her a bit. So another patient who we do not have DNA of, although I have the DNA of her niece, this patient's niece is alive and contacted me saying that, you know, could she be carrying a gene causing the gigantism in her own uncle. And this niece was negative for AIP, and most probably the patient itself would have been negative for AIP, because very likely that he had the X chromosome microduplication, because the pattern of his growth matching very much the one with the patients with X chromosome microduplication. And here is yet another patient who at the age of 10 years was 190 centimeters. So again, without DNA, we will not know, but very likely could have had the disease of the X-Lax syndrome. So the current tallest man is this particular patient here, and he was measured by the Guinness Book of Records for kind of getting the title of the tallest man. And we tested his DNA, and he's also positive for the X-Lax disease and has a microduplication. But when we communicated these results with the patient, he immediately asked a very important question, and he just recently got married, so he asked about his offsprings. So if the disease truly can be transmitted by males as well, not just females, current data suggests families with female transmission, then his children, his male children would be fine, but all his female offsprings would have the gene and would be affected by the disease. So he probably will need assisted for his fertility some assistance, but in that case, if they do an IVF for a boy, he might have a healthy offspring. There are very few cases of tall stature or gigantism with a normal growth hormone and high IGF-1, and there was one case described a few years ago, actually was presented at ENDO, where they identified a mutation in the SOX2 gene. So just to remind you that this is the growth hormone receptor, which works via JAK-STAT pathway. But there is an inhibitor protein, the SOX2 protein here. So they suggested that there was a loss of function mutation in SOX2, and therefore their patient had normal or low growth hormone levels, but very high IGF-1 levels. There is another patient from Dr. Gitama from Argentina, and this is quite an amazing case. This is the patient with his doctor, and the growth hormone level using several different assays was undetectable or extremely low, while the IGF-1 was 1,000. She performed several MRIs on these patients, and the MRI of the patient is showing a normal pituitary gland. There is no history suggesting apoplexy. So it's no good explanation. We sequenced the SOX2 gene in this patient, and it was negative. And we actually also put his DNA through the X chromosome microduplication, expecting that he will not be affected, and truly he is not affected by that gene. So at this point, we don't have an explanation of the gigantism of this particular patient. If we think of gigants, we can, of course, talk about high growth hormone and or IGF-1 levels, but there are other causes of tall stature. We all know about Klinefelters and congenital hypogonadotrophic hypogonadism patients. We also know about Marfan syndrome patients who could be taller, fragile X patient. A very interesting observation from a Swiss group suggested that patients with hemochromatosis have plenty of iron in their childhood, and this might explain their slightly taller stature compared to the appropriate control population. But this study was just a letter in the New England, and I haven't seen anything repeated on this. Tall stature, especially in children, could be a result of various overgrowth syndromes. And just an example is Sotos syndrome or Weaver syndrome. And I show you here some pictures with very typical facial features of Weaver syndrome with a mutation in the EZH2 gene and showing the growth curve of these subjects. An extremely unusual and problematic patient has been described with a mutation in the HMGA2 gene, and we know this gene very well from experimental studies affecting the growth hormone axis, and this patient was extremely tall at the age of 8 years but had multiple other problems. So I'm coming now to this pathway, the C-natriuretic peptide and natriuretic receptor pathway, which is an important pathway for chondrocyte development. And the reason why I'm showing it, because these patients have very typical features of scoliosis, and especially these long toes. And this is a patient with an overexpression of the ligand of the receptor, and this is a patient with an activating mutation for that receptor with tall stature, extremely, over 4 SD, and these very long toes. This particular person, who is, you probably know him from various films, was born with an extremely high birth weight. He had already 2 teeth at birth. He already had a problem with his spine at birth. He, at the end, reached a height of 234, so very much fulfilling all the criteria for gigantism. But he had a normal growth hormone and IGF-1 axis, and he had an extremely large shoe size, practically, because he had this long toe. So this is a patient when he was older, and he died since, so it's not able to test his DNA. But I think it's very likely that he had an abnormality on this pathway based on these phenotypic features. This is a milder case from Holland, and it shows a patient with the hand showing these very long fingers. He does not have the toe abnormalities, so it seems that it's not 100% at all these patients, but he has a mutation in the receptor, and it looks that it's a milder case, and he has some mild scoliosis. So he's clearly very tall, even compared to this tall but healthy Dutch endocrinologist. And the reason why this is interesting that it's coming from Holland, because there was a study looking at SNPs in this particular gene, and we know that the Dutch people are one of the tallest people on the earth, and they found that in this cohort of general population subjects, there were 2 SNPs affecting the C-natriuretic peptide. So this could be an explanation for the tall stature in Holland. And they also found another SNP in the number 3 natriuretic peptide receptor on the 5th chromosome. So this just suggests that the variation in tall stature could be due to this. There are patients with no known abnormality. This is a healthy person from England who works as an actor most of the time, and apparently he is truly healthy and nothing wrong with him, although his height fulfills the gigantism. And there is also this historical brothers from Texas. Again, if this is true, then really tall stature, all of them, with apparently no other abnormalities as far as we understand. So many of the cases with gigantism has now a good explanation, but certainly not all. So giants sometimes use or have to use their height for whatever they are doing. So they are part of shows, or they are work as actors, or they work as a boxer in boxing or wrestling. This particular patient is Maurice Tillet, who was actually a very intelligent man. He spoke 14 languages, and he was a poet. And people say that Shrek was based on his character, but we don't know if it's really true or not. And, of course, many of them, at least at the beginning of the disease, they can work as basketball players, but usually that's unfortunately not long-term unless they are treated. Giants have been treated by the society not always the best way. There are a number of cases where we know that the body was stolen after the patient's death and was exhibited, and the prime example of this one is the patient I showed you already in the Hunterian Museum in London, whose skeleton was taken by the Scottish physician John Hunter to put it into his medical museum. But there are other examples also in France, patients' skeletons taken despite their expressed wishes not to be exhibited. Robert Wadlow, who is the tallest man ever, had an intrusion into his life and was given untrue descriptions. And his family actually sued Dr. Humbert, one of the endocrinologists at the time, and also the American Medical Association. And I'm pretty sure that at the time, I think the case was lost by the patient, but today it would have been a very different outcome. And another case of injustice done to the stent when an autopsy was performed on one of Professor Cushing's patients. And this has been recently published by Alfredo Quirones Hinojosa in the journal Pituitary, where they describe that this poor patient who is in the book of Harvey Cushing on pituitary disorders, while the rest of the family were sitting in the church, the body was in the coffin outside. The colleagues of Cushing's actually did an autopsy in the coffin and removed the pituitary gland and the area, and it's really completely unacceptable what happened at the time, but unfortunately that was the case. Giants are not very happy people. They really don't enjoy being so tall as they are. Of course, they are often are affected by hypogonadism, but also this description about Robert Wadlow, the boy was so shy as to appear depressed or almost stupid, and that was, of course, in stark contrast with his excellent school records. Also, Cushing describes one of his cases, but his size was an embarrassment and he became a truant. And many patients kind of describe that one of their major wishes would be to walk down the street without people staring at them. So we need to take into account when we're dealing with these patients that the way they look and then the way that their disease is actually sitting on their outlook all the time is really gives a huge burden on them. In the past, patients with gigantism had very early mortality. Usually they died in their 20s. Now that we can treat these patients better, this certainly improved a lot. This particular patient, one of the tallest persons on the earth, died recently at the age of 46 years. This is another patient in our hospital who just died very recently at the age of 68. He was treated with primary radiotherapy and clearly did quite well coming to this point. And also a few months ago, this American actor died of the disease at a very nice age for a giant at the age of 76. So we are improving, but I think the main thing what we need to do with this disease is actually prevent the development of gigantism, and the work from the Finnish group identifying the AIP gene and also now the work from Strotakis' group will help us to achieve this goal if we indeed can chase down the families and stop the disease developing. So I come to the Irish Giants, and Irish Giants this Irish Giant who's in the Trinity College was studied by Cunningham in 1891 and actually helped to identify the pituitary disease together with the gigantism is important. And the one in the Hunterian Museum was studied by Cushing himself, who actually opened the skull here and saw what's inside, which is the enlarged pituitary fossa. And this particular case actually was published four times throughout the last 100 years or so. But our story with the Irish Giants started with Michael Besser back in 1974, when this 19-year-old patient walked through the door with gigantism. And this patient is the same one standing with me here in the Hunterian Museum looking at a skeleton which belonged to a patient who actually seems to be that was his relative. So we identified in this patient a mutation in the AIP gene, and we also identified it in four other families, and they were all from Ireland. So we were wondering, is there a link between these patients having the same mutation and coming from the same part of the world? And if we look at the map, we can see that the first family we identified lived in this little village here, and then the patient I showed you on the photograph lived here, another family lived here, and then the patient whose skeleton is in the museum lived here, and on the picture I showed you earlier, the twin giants, they live just here. So clearly within a small area, quite a number of patients where we know that they all had the CO4 stop mutation. So from the skeleton, we actually removed the tooth and identified the mutation in him as well. So after this, we realized that in the area, there are quite a few more giants. So here's a patient meeting a person who also suffers from gigantism since the age of 19. And there is another one who's practically the same height as him and just lived 10 miles from him. And then learning more about this, this is an Irish writer, William Carleton, from the 19th century. He describes in his autobiography about a celebrated Irish giant, Big Magee, a man of Colossus from a village called Clogher. And if you look at the map compared to these villages, this village is just here, living very close. And this is another example from poet Benjamin Linus, who actually wrote a poem called The Irish Giant, and he wrote this poem again back in the early 19th century, where he mentions two brothers who have gigantism living in this village, again, not far from the area. And in this poem, he also mentions the patient Magee from Clogher. So there are other Irish giants as well. This is one from the 1600s, where James Plessis writes in The Short History of Human Prodigies and Dwarves that he met this lady, a well-proportioned giantess who was 7 feet high without her shoes, who was born on the Isle of Portrush, which is just north of the area I showed you, not far from the wonderful Giant's Causeway in the most northern part of Ireland. And this is another Irish patient at the age of 17, and yet another one from Killowen, again, not far from the area I showed you. And there is this patient called James Kirkland, who belonged to the army of the Lungan Celts. So I need to mention, when we talk about giants, King Friedrich William, who was the soldier king in Germany. He himself wasn't very tall, but he really was keen on tall soldiers. So he started to collect an army of giants. The entry criteria was 188 centimeters, and he actually became quite obsessed with this issue, so had soldiers as gifts from all over the world. And sometimes he had quite aggressive recruitments, practically kidnapping tall boys to come into his army. He never sent the giant army to the war, and there are several explanations. One is that they thought they are too precious to be killed eventually in a war, and the other is that maybe the giants were not healthy enough to be in a war. At the time of the death of him, he had 3,861 soldiers who belonged to his tall army. What is very interesting that in the last couple of years, there is a reenactment guard of the tall fellows from Potsdam. So there is now a club of these patients, and the entry criteria is still the same. You have to be 188 centimeters to enter the club, and this is a recent picture when they were doing something in Germany. I would like to talk about Patrick Cotter, who was also an Irish giant, and he was a contemporary of Charles Byrne, and he knew what happened to his body when he died, as taken to by John Hunter. So when he died, he was buried in three coffins in a grave dug 12 feet deep in a solid rock underneath the floor of a Roman Catholic chapel in Bristol. And in 1906, this church was renovated, and they found the skeleton, and it was studied by the anatomy professor at the time and wrote a paper about him. And then he was found here under the St. Joseph Hall, under the stairs here. And after studying his skeleton, they buried him back in the church, just in a different location, in 1909. But in 1974, this church again underwent another kind of a renovation. And then they found the bones again, and this time it was studied by Dr. Musgrave from Bristol University. And if you look at the x-ray, what he made of the right leg, it's really important to understand that every single picture you see of Patrick Cotter, he always leans on something with his right arm, and you now understand why he probably couldn't really stand, let alone walk, with this level of arthropathy on his right leg. So in 1974, he was reburied at the same place, in the same church. But in 1986, he was found again. Poor guy. But at the time, the architect who was in charge of the development of the area, who heard about the story of Charles Byrne, and he knew of the wishes of the patients that he does not want to be disturbed and does not want to be studied. So in 1986, he decided that the bones need to be cremated, and indeed they were in 1986. So when I found out about my story of the Irish Giants and tried to contact Dr. Musgrave, he told me that it's not available for me to study. Quite rightly, I think. So this Irish Giant I mentioned already, so we tested him also for the AIP mutation, and actually he does not harbor the iron. So not all Irish Giants would be R304X positives. But it's interesting that he was born in the southern part of Ireland. So all the patients we identify now with the 304 stop mutation are mainly from the northern part of Ireland, or living just a bit off, or moved to England or Scotland. It was really this case of a 9-year-old boy very recently who was identified with this 4-centimeter tumor, which made me realize that we really have to do to screen for this mutation in this area. And we decided to do a population screening when we went to two small towns very close to the area I showed you on the map. And we spent 4 days on 2 weekends collecting almost 1,000 samples in the local food store, practically asking the customers to give us a bit of DNA sample, which they did, and we identified whether they carry the mutation or not. It was very interesting that while we were standing there, some of the patients rushed home and came back with some pictures. So this was a 75-year-old lady who came back with a newspaper from 1913 showing her own uncle, who was this person on the picture, who was 211 centimeter tall and actually died a few weeks after this photograph was taken of a hypertensive crisis. So she was very keen to know, being the niece of this patient, whether she carries the mutation. And then another patient was a great-nephew of this particular guy here, who again was born in a neighboring village. And what was also interesting for us, that when he showed us this picture with his great-uncle, we asked him, who is this guy? And he said, well, I don't know who is this guy, but clearly he is looking as acromegalic and as giant as this one. So again, just people from the local area showing new Irish Giants living in the area. So looking at the growth hormone adenoma patients in Belfast and Dublin, looking at all our Irish origin patients within our cohort, and looking at population samples from Belfast and Ireland, in addition to the local population screening in those villages I showed you on the map, we identified altogether 18 pedigrees where we could show that they have exactly the same mutation, with 102 carriers and almost half of them being affected with a tumor. And identifying their microsatellites, we found that they all belong to the original founder Irish mutation. So having now a lot more families, we try to recalculate when was the founder mutation living, and actually using some very sophisticated mathematical modeling and about 10,000 stimulation, how the 18 families, what we have now here, could have gone back to a single founder mutation. We identified that this mutation probably present in the area 102 years ago, which is 2,550 years. Roughly, with obviously quite a large credible interval up to 4,500 years. And I find this writing from the history of mankind from 1813 really, really interesting. In Ireland, men of uncommon stature are often seen, and even of gigantic form and stature occur there more frequently than in this island. Yet all the British Isles derive their stock of inhabitants from the same sources. We can hardly avoid the conclusion that there must be some peculiarity in Ireland which gives rise to these phenomena. Well, I believe that is the AIP founder mutation. So I would like to finish just a few issues about mythological giants. We already talked about Goliath, and there is Orion, who is a blind giant who had a helper kind of driving him through. So one wonders whether blind giant, what could be the cause there. Also, there is another giant who has something wrong with his vision, but apparently Odysseus decided to blind him, so that might not be due to the gigantism. So these were kind of giants who were not very positive figures, but there are also figures such as Hercules, Prometheus, or St. Christopher who are positive giants within mythology. I already showed you other pictures of David and Goliath, but there are giants, for example, a giant female from Peter Bruegel's a painting found in Antwerp showing a giant lady here. And also we found it in other mythologies. For example, in the Hindu mythology, there is a giant, Taraka, and apparently she has a sister who was constantly having breast milk, even without a baby. Again, you wonder whether this was a pair of sisters, maybe with the X-leg syndromes. I already mentioned that Cushing's draw our attention to Rabelais' giant family of Gargantua and Pantagruel, and these are the original drawings of this family. could have been based on some real patients with mutations. The Nordic folktales often talk about three giant brothers who live in the northern part of the country. And this beautiful drawing from Kittelsand tells about this story showing one of these giant brothers. And I can't stop thinking that the mutation was actually found in families who live in the northern part of Finland. So again, these folklore could be related to the facts. Another folklore is that in the Solomon Islands there are legends about giants, and also during the Second World War these Japanese soldiers told about the Solomon Island giants. And Dr. Anne McCormack in Sydney identified AIP mutation in a patient with gigantism who is from the Solomon Islands. And of course the Irish story with lots of Irish folk tales and the giant causeway known, and then the mutation which we identified now in many Irish patients. So I would like to finish with this writer, Jonathan Swift, who lived in Dublin, but in 720 he decided to spend the summer in this lovely house in the northern part of the country. And this house is located right here. He was writing a book during that summer, and the title of the book is Gulliver's Travels. With that, I would like to thank you for your attention. And thank my mentors and trainees and all the colleagues who collaborate with me, and especially Wouter the Herder, who is obviously the father of all history of gigantism. Thank you so much.
So thank you very much. I apologize we didn't have a chance to introduce you. This was a wonderful lecture, and thank you very much for your participation.